Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on defending against TCPA lawsuits. The TCPA, while around for nearly three decades now, is enjoying a bit of a renaissance lately thanks to a couple of lawsuits that have thrown complying with the law into some bit of chaos. To help guide us through the fog is a trio of legal experts who are here to share their advice and insights. This webinar is being generously sponsored by TCN. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Dave Linares heads up the legal and compliance team at DCI, along with several other support areas within the organization. David is well-versed in both the regulatory and legal landscape, as well as operations and its challenges, having led teams in both realms. Able to draw from his experience, David develops his teams to rely on forward-thinking methodologies in order to face industry challenges head-on while adjusting to the ever-changing minefield that is the ARM regulatory landscape. Judd Peek is responsible for the creation, implementation, and continual oversight of the enterprise-wide compliance management system at the Frost Arnett Company. In this role, he ensures that the compliance program aligns with the overall corporate strategy, business plan, and code of ethics at Frost Arnett. Judd also oversees multiple compliance information, tracking, and monitoring systems. Prior to his role as chief compliance officer, Judd spent 16 years as an attorney in private practice, specializing in employee relations issues. Nicole Strickler focuses her practice in the defense of consumer litigation, including the FDCPA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, TCPA, and the Illinois Collection Agency Act. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, lawyers, as well as individuals. She is an active member of ACA International, the Consumer Financial Division of the American Bar Association, and holds a position on the board of directors of the National Creditors Bar Association. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please type it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Because we're going to be talking about some compliance and legal topics today, let me read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not his or her organization. And with that, let's jump into today's discussion. Looking at the TCPA landscape today as it stands, Judd, let me start with a fairly broad question. In what areas are collection agencies most vulnerable when it comes to complying with the TCPA?
You're right. That is a broad question. it's kind of unique. Like today, if we're talking about, fourth quarter 2019, to me, it's a lot more uncertain than it was certainly a year and a half ago. So with the decision in ACA International and the kind of the court throwing out the FCC's ruling a couple years before that, the recent decision in Marks, I think the main challenge or vulnerability I see is just in the varying jurisdictions that have different standards, different interpretations of the TCPA, specifically what constitutes an automated telephonic dialing system or an ATDS. That to me, that's the biggest challenge from the practitioner side, from the implementation side, just trying to devise a strategy, especially if you have national collections that complies with all these various circuits that are now going in divergent directions on what is allowable and what isn't allowable. To me, that's kind of the vulnerability, is trying to mess something up when it's very uncertain and very complicated.
If that vulnerability only expands when you think about it, right, and the circuits, their decisions really rely on the person that's sitting in that judge's chair. There are definitely a lot of things that agencies can do to kind of protect themselves, and I'm sure we're going to get into that here in a little bit. But, I mean, the key point always seems to boil down to the actual definition of an ATDS, and that's how we continue to see these challenges surface within the industry. I think that Marx was definitely an outlier, but I mean, it's just a continuous minefield. There's no easy way in or out. It's just something that we have to monitor pretty closely and consistently.
Okay, so monitoring is obviously important, David. Just like you said, how do you go about doing that? Like, is that just something where you're sort of reading news sites, you're keeping up with sort of your legal counsel and what they're saying? What's the process?
It's a little bit of both, right? There's no such thing as information overload when it comes to TCPA because it's challenged so often. But we, at least here at DCI, we have our own outside counsel that we utilize to keep us abreast of everything that's happening. Our team stays pretty close into the newsletters, both Counts Recovery, we have Inside Arm, ACA, every source of information that you could possibly find. Is the worst thing that you can do when it comes to TCPA or any regulation for that matter is be in the dark, because your liability just builds as you stay in the dark.
All right, just keeping up on my notes. Is that how you would, looking from the outside, Nicole, is that how you would sort of assess the largest vulnerability for collection agencies when it comes to the TCPA? Is just sort of managing, how the law is being applied on a region by region or jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis?
I would agree that we are kind of in a difficult environment right now, just because there's a different range of decisions on what constitutes an ATDS and what doesn't. But I guess the way I look at it is, when Marx came down, that decision really wasn't all that different than what the FCC had already said, and I realized, ACA International came out and kind of threw that out of the window, but I think a lot of people were already complying with the TCPA or developing their compliance programs as if Marx was already the law. I don't know that it really changed that much. I still think there's systems out there that have been tested under that, FCC 2015 ruling, and I wouldn't say, been given a blessing, because obviously things can change, but there have been a lot of good decisions out there and a lot of good work done by some of the vendors out there, where, you can still kind of rely on those. But yeah, I would agree. You kind of just have to keep abreast of, where the cases are going and if there's a change. And the best way to do that is through, honestly, the industry trade organizations, through your publication, Mike, your webinars, stuff like that. Having someone in your industry or in your organization, be mindful of it.
Hey, Mike, one thing I'd like to follow up on the kind of the talk on staying on top of developments and knowledgeable about the constant change of the TCPA landscape. I do caution, I personally don't want to be knee-jerky about anything. So, for instance, when the Marx decision came out, I read it, tried to understand it, went, but didn't initially change anything as far as our strategy goes. We tweaked a few things, we kind of try to isolate the Ninth Circuit states a little bit differently than the rest of the country. But I don't want to do anything, then I think that's a good example, that the reaction is larger than the challenge or the problem that the decision might present to us. So I do think it's worthwhile to just kind of caution that, stay on top of things, but really I prefer to let things kind of gel and solidify before I take any drastic changes to our strategy.
And I mean, that's a great point. I mean, not even too long ago, the Ninth Circuit had another decision. Was it Satterfield versus Simon and Schuster, I think, where it was a completely different direction that they took with the definition of an ATDS. And then, this happens with Marx in the Ninth Circuit. So you never know what comes tomorrow. And so long as you're confident in the compliance of your system, like Nicole was saying, there are several systems out there that offer that now. Then generally, you should be okay with just small adjustments.
Yeah, I think the bigger thing too is, you know, when you're thinking about your system and you're thinking about your compliance policies, you know, a lot of it too comes down to consent. Like, are you capturing consent? How are you doing that? And, you know, I do think the industry is getting a lot better with that. I think that the original creditors are getting a lot better with that by putting, you know, good language in their agreements about the method by which, you know, they and, you know, their subsequent assignees can contact the consumers. We're seeing a lot more of that, which is helpful. You know, documenting revocations, you know, stuff like that, which I think just overall helps limit the potential for class liability. So, I mean, there are other avenues to combat, you know, the potential mass class action nightmare, you know, by obviously looking at your technology, but also by, you know, keeping consent in mind and what your policies and procedures look like relevant to that.
Going back to what you were saying, Judd, in terms of sort of kind of letting things settle, is there a period of time that you do? Like, is it a week, a month, or, you know, how do you sort of manage yourself in that time, or how long do you sort of sit and wait before you make any decisions about what, you know, what changes should be made?
Yeah, that's going to be a big "it depends" answer. So, you know, I would certainly wait longer than a week or a month before you do any sort of major capital expenditure change. If you're going to change your dialing system because what three judges in San Francisco might have ruled a couple months ago, well, that's a bit of an extreme reaction. But if you want to tweak the frequency of dialing, or if you have two systems and one of which is more conservative than the other as far as TCPA compliance goes, you know, switch that into it, that could be a reasonable switch. You know, as far as like the Marks decision specifically goes, I'm kind of taking a wait and see approach. I want to see what happens. It's still in litigation. I don't think that decision is necessarily the final word for the Ninth Circuit. So I don't want to do anything that we'd have to undo at some point in the future.
So even though there's this sort of this ruling out there that, you know, sort of really kind of puts a damper on what collection agencies may be able to do, you're still going to hold off just to kind of wait and see what happens, whether there's an en banc, whether it goes to the Supreme Court, and what happens to that first?
Exactly, yeah. I think they are trying to get an en banc hearing, which for any of the attendees that don't understand the difference, the initial decision was a three-judge panel, and I believe the defendant in that case has petitioned the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to hear the case again, which is discretionary. They don't have to, but they have requested them to do that, and I think that, as far as I know, that has not been ruled upon whether they will have a rehearing on that point or not. But, you know, I mean, for my company specifically, you know, we feel pretty good about our what technology we do use. As Nicole mentioned, there are products out there that are TCPA compliant before Marks and after Marks. You know, Marks talked about human intervention on the initial side of loading numbers, but didn't really touch on the human intervention element for initiating the calls. And there are products out there that's their TCPA compliance factor, is that human intervention side on the call initiation, which I think still exists in my reading of Marks. It's still an allowable technology even under the Ninth Circuit's decision. So I'm just kind of seeing where that goes, and hopefully if we need to change something, it'll be a minor change and not major. I certainly don't want to overreact.
Excellent. Thank you. David, curious, you know, are you following a similar strategy, or sort of how are, you know, what recommendations would you give to collection agencies in terms of adapting their business, given the FCC is working on a rule, given this Marks case is still pending, and, you know, whatever else is going on out there?
Well, I definitely agree with Judd. I follow the same wait and see approach. And my reading of Marks, and just coming back to Marks for a moment, when I look at it, I see that there's a big focus on the words and or, right? Between whether or not a system can sequentially dial and randomly dial numbers that are stored. There's an AND and an OR in there that drastically, in the Marx case, it gets differentiated from what the TCPA's definition of an ATDS is. In my personal opinion, I don't think that will hold after this appeal, and I'd be curious to see what the FCC rule will be at the end of it. But I mean, judging by the temperature of the FCC right now, I don't think that Marx will be such a major issue to the industry. I think that Marx at the moment is kind of the point of focus because it was such an outlier decision. So it's definitely a wait and see with just minor tweaks and adjustments to the state that we have within the Ninth Circuit. But the way that we have the business set up here, those tweaks are very, very minor, very minute, hardly noticeable to anybody that isn't within the organization itself. So the name of the game is definitely avoiding that knee-jerk reaction, because you may end up doing more harm than good if you adjust to how you dial nationally based on a decision that impacts only a certain number of states and is still very much up.
Hey, Mike, I had one other thought. As far as we're talking about, yep, you know, how to appropriately and measured react to this decision or any development like that, you know, while I'm taking a wait and see as far as our internal strategy goes, I'm definitely using the Marx decision as fuel to go back to our clients. You know, pre-Marx, after Marx, prior express consent is still a TCPA get out of jail free card. So if you're obtaining express consent from the consumers to dial them, it doesn't matter anything about the technology you use to do that. And, you know, one of my mantras that I keep hammering with our clientele is get that consent from your clients, from your customers on the front end. We do a lot of healthcare, and that would be upon patient intake for us. And this is just another talking point for us to use with our clients about the importance of getting that prior express consent before the account is ever placed for collections.
I definitely agree with that, just to chime in, but there's also a measure of caution that you have to use, right? That won't always be the case for every agency. For example, we do a lot of telecom, and while a lot of it is on the prime side, we do have some that's a little bit older, right? And so the consent may not necessarily apply once you get into the tertiary or the quaternary markets, where that phone number may have shifted from what was originally provided from the client. So you definitely have to make sure that you have controls in place to capture that sort of information and obtain consent either at that first point of contact or make whatever business decision you're going to make.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I just want to pause the discussion for a minute and talk a little bit about the sponsor of today's webinar, TCN. TCN is a leading provider of cloud-based call center technology for enterprises, contact centers, BPOs, and collection agencies worldwide. Founded in 1999, TCN combines a deep understanding of the needs of call center users with a highly affordable delivery model, ensuring immediate access to robust call center technology, such as predictive dialer, IVR, call recording, and business analytics required to optimize operations and adhere to TCPA regulations. Its always-on cloud-based delivery model provides customers with immediate access to the latest version of the TCN solution, as well as the ability to quickly and easily scale and adjust to evolving business needs. TCN serves various Fortune 500 companies and enterprises in multiple industries, including newspaper, collection, education, healthcare, automotive, political, customer service, and marketing. TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding TCPA changes and how it is changing the industry. TCN regularly speaks to local and national leaders to help educate them on matters of TCPA and compliance for the betterment of the industry as a whole. For more information, visit www.tcnp3.com. Thanks again to TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. I'm sure I speak for all of us listening today when I say we appreciate your generous support. Now, let's get back to our discussion. So we've talked a little bit about what's going on with regard to complying with the TCPA and some of the legal questions and that are sort of still outstanding and likely to be outstanding for some time. So let me raise this chestnut, Nicole. Is this a good time to consider alternative communication methods such as text messaging or sending emails or, you know, other technology like direct dot voicemails as opposed to making phone calls?
So I think that's something that's been on people's minds for quite a while now. I certainly, as outside counsel to a lot of organizations, get that question a lot and getting it a lot more frequently lately. you know, I think the key is that there's ways to comply with these alternative technologies. My feeling is too, is I know a lot of companies believe that, email, text message, these are the communications that are most likely to reach the younger subset of the population, like millennials. And so it's key for them to use them regardless of, the current landscape of the TCPA, basically. I think the main thing to keep in mind when you're looking at these types of technologies is, again, to develop your compliance program. There's rules with email. You know, New York has specific consent requirements for email, and their rules, have things that you specifically need to do if you're going to be emailing consumers as a debt collector. For text messages, and it's been pretty much universally determined by the courts that a text is a call, and the FCC agrees. So, you're still going to be having that TCPA discussion. And then with direct drop voicemails, there's also still TCPA implications, because there are cases out there that have held that the direct drop voicemail is a call and subject to TCPA. So, there's still a lot of discussions out there about compliance and with these other alternative methods of communication. But that being said, what I generally tell my clients is there's a way to do it compliantly. It's not that you can't use these technologies, it's just that you have to know what you're doing and you have to develop your compliance program first before you start using it. And, it's an ongoing process of keeping updated, again, just like with the TCPA, about what the rules are and how to do so compliantly.
I mean, the key point is that, the debtor base is getting younger, but regulation is not getting younger. And so there are definitely ways, like Nicole was saying, that we can adapt and make sure that we are complying with these technologies, but make sure, to her point, that you are vetting them out very, very closely, and that you have everything properly documented. You have your policies, your procedures, and you have controls in place more than anything else. So if you ever deviate from what you've set as the standard, you can catch that and you can repair it very, very quickly. One strategy that I've used before when I was still in the operations realm was definitely utilizing text messages and definitely utilizing emails, but only after we made that first right party contact. So we made sure that we captured that consent thusly and clearly, as opposed to relying on something that may have come from a client or a prior vendor.
I think that's a really good point, David, because I think sometimes people are kind of thinking about the compliance program after they've already, started using the technology. And, it's not something you want to do in retrospect. It's something that you want to do first. And I just add to what you said too, that, it's important that you do your own analysis of the technology and not just rely on the vendors or the white papers that the vendors are putting out, because, I've had occasion where I've read, the white papers that have been given by vendors about how this technology is, 100% TCPA compliant. And I think you have to be really careful when you're relying on stuff like that, instead of getting your own outside opinion about, where the risks lie.
Judd, are you using that text messaging, digital or email or direct on voicemail, using any more of that or any less of that, especially as it sort of pertains to complying with the TCPA?
Not as a response to changes within the TCPA landscape. So mimicking what Nicole and David mentioned a minute ago, I think those are independent determinations. So they're important to be able to reach a broader sector of consumers, especially ones that don't answer their phone, but they present their own challenges. And I don't think there's anything in development of the TCPA that would really mandate a switch to those, or at least not be the primary reason why you'd switch communication channels. I think they need to stand on their own substantiation to the extent that it works for you strategically. Just not to be lost on the audience, but the Marx decision out of the Ninth Circuit was a text messaging decision under the TCPA. So text messages are subject to the TCPA just like any sort of calls to mobile cell phones. So that's not going to be a switch in order to be TCPA compliant. You're just going to have to develop those technologies because they help increase your right party contact rates, or they help get consumers on the phone so they can resolve their accounts. I think those are the factors that should weigh more heavily in use of those alternate channels rather than just trying to avoid liability under the TCPA.
We've talked a little bit about, or not a little bit, we talked about consent and the importance of obtaining it and sort of keeping that sort of at the forefront of every conversation that an agency is having. I'm curious, how do you integrate that concept or that, a culture of consent, for lack of a better phrase that I can't think of right now, into your scripts or into the conversations that collectors are having with individuals? Does anyone want to take that one first?
Sure. No, I guess I'll. Did you say Nicole? I'm sorry.
No, I threw it out to the panel.
Oh, gotcha. Then yeah, and then you're sorry. I thought I heard Nicole.
And then I panicked. I was like, did he say me? Oh no.
No. See, I think that it's definitely something that you need to integrate, even if it's not something that you're going to use on all your business lines. It's good to have. I've always utilized the obtaining of consent, at least when it's a right party contact with the consumer. Once you're past that point of verification, all that good stuff, and you're actually in the meat and potatoes of the conversation where you're negotiating, where you have less of a chance of, for example, losing a consumer on the phone because you ask them a question that make them feel uncomfortable. The key really is making sure that you're logging that consent and you give clear ways to, and maybe not on that phone call, but you have clear ways to redact that consent if the consumer were ever to ask that consent be redacted. And consent is great for subsequent phone calls, but really depending, or subsequent communication of any form, but really depending on the line of business that you utilize, you'd rely on consent more heavily or more lightly. That really depends on the business strategy and what counsel might guide you, or which way counsel might guide you, but it's always something good to have.
We've never had much success.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nicole. I was just kind of play off what David mentioned. We've never had a lot of success using our talk-offs on conversations as a means of obtaining consent from the consumers. So for us, consent comes passed down from our clients. And even once it's already in the collection process, we've already, more often than not, dialed out on an account before we ever talk to the consumer. So either you're having different dialing strategies based on before our first contact's ever made, or at least first telephone contact is ever made, and after, seems fairly complicated to me. Nothing we've been able to implement with too much success. I think the best opportunities for that on the collection agency side would be during that period of time, incorporated into your collector scripting or talk-offs, after the initial validation letter has been sent, but maybe if you get a first response that the consumer calls in from that letter, then that's a good opportunity for you to try to obtain that express consent to call in the future, or to send text messages, whatever it may be. I think there's a good way to get that consent and make sure that the best way to make sure that you're documenting it properly, make sure all your calls are recorded. If you have the recording of the consumer giving express authorization to use an automated telephone dialing system or to receive text messages or whatever you want, just make sure you maintain that call recording during the lifespan of the account.
I was just going to add that I always just find it interesting to hear what agencies and organizations are doing to capture consent, because by the time I'm usually involved, it's at the point where someone's been sued, and usually in a class action context. So I can just tell you, just from my experience, or the audience out there, things that I've seen to be helpful in the defense context, which, like you mentioned, Judd, is the talk off or the scripts. The good thing about, even if I guess, it would be you all would know more than me how successful it is in getting consent, but I think if you build it into your script correctly, it can really serve as quite the tool in defeating the class action if your policy and procedure is every time, you know, the collector's speaking to the consumer, they say something to the effect of, you know, is this a good number for us to call you on? And the consumer says yes. Like building that policy into your, or building that script into your policy can really serve as a really nice defense tool, because for class action context, if I can provide that type of evidence to the consumer attorney to say, hey, maybe on this one-off call, we didn't have the consent or for this one-off account, but let me tell you what our policy and procedure is. And here's a bunch of examples of us doing it over the past X amount of time. And so you're never going to get class certification because, you know, this is a one-off. This isn't an example of a real, you know, pattern and practice by us of calling without consent.
And Nicole, I think that's a really great point that I forgot to make, but I thought of that before. Is, you know, to me, it's a watershed, not a watershed moment, but a really threshold issue when you talk about TCPA liability, the single claims versus the class action. You know, one you can manage, the other one is about the business issue. Mm-hmm. And to the extent you can have processes in place, such as doing that that consent language in your talk-offs, that make each claim an individualized assessment, that's going to go a long way towards defeating class certification. So if you're having to do an individualized analysis on every consumer, whether they gave consent on an oral recording, whether they provided consent to the original creditor that transferred on to the collection agency, all those things that you look at on an individualized basis will help to defeat a class action. And if you're stuck with just one consumer or one plaintiff instead of an entire class of plaintiffs, that's going to make your analysis and your ability to withstand a claim a lot more palpable.
Jed, going back to something you said, is consent just a one-time thing? First time you get the person on the phone, you get it and you hold on to it until they revoke it? Or is it something where every time you're in touch with them, are you continually trying to ask for it?
Well, we definitely do not do the latter. We don't run through the same language on every call. For instance, if they're calling in to make another payment or something like that. I think what you want to make sure you do, though, is the specific language you use to obtain that consent, make sure that it is, it's forward-looking, to where that consent will last for future communications, you know, even future different telephone numbers that this consumer might obtain to third-party business associates or business partners. You make sure it's broad enough to apply to future situations, and that will be the best way to protect you.
Is there language, Nicole, sorry, I'm going to say it this time, that you recommend collection agencies use in terms of scripting how to ask for consent?
Well, the best language, of course, is going to be something to the effect of, hello, Mr. Consumer, do I have your consent to call you as much as I want using my really tech-savvy auto dialer whenever I desire?
Yes, absolutely.
But of course, that's not going to happen. So, usually the best types of consent I've seen that it has the best result of the consumer saying yes is something informal, to the extent of, is this a good number for us to call you on? Or is this a good number for us to contact you on? I think I can make the argument from that constitutes consent. I'm asking, this is a good number for me to call you on. And at the same time, the consumer's not really looking at it like necessarily like they're, you know, giving you consent to auto dial them, because most people are not going to say yes to that. But at the same time, they're kind of saying, oh, they're just trying to confirm what's a good number for me. That's a normal question for them to ask. So that's usually what I tell my clients and what I've seen them have the most success with.
Got it. So we've been talking so far about kind of preventing future TCPA lawsuits. Let's spend a few minutes talking about ones that may have already been filed. Given all of the sort of the legal uncertainty that's out there, would you recommend, or would you think it would be a good strategy for collection agencies to try and seek stays in any current TCPA cases in order to wait for either a new FCC rule or some other subsequent or final ruling in March. Maybe David, you can take that one first this time.
Sure. I think that that really depends almost entirely on what your legal strategies are and what your internal processes are. I think if you have very, very strong processes internally where you've been able to defeat some TCPA claims, there's tons of precedent out there where agencies have defeated TCPA claims based on the system that they utilize in the human intervention and the definition of an ATDS within the TCPA. If that's the case, you know, seeking a stay might not be the best alternative for you. But if you have something that's closer to the Marks case, then maybe in that case you would want to seek a stay. I can tell you that personally, the new FCC rule and just the way that we're operating internally, that's not really an option that I'm looking at currently. But it's definitely a new tool in the arsenal now, seeing as we are waiting on some of these decisions.
I think the tough part about like asking for a stay, and I can tell you it's very jurisdictional based whether or not that would even be granted, because the courts really look at that very differently. Some courts, you could say, hey, there's a ruling that's coming out in 3 weeks, please stay the case, and they'll say no, they don't care. Others are more apt to stay, but the problem with the FCC ruling is we really don't know when it's going to come out. So the FCC, you know, takes its sweet time, as most government agencies do. And so if you're going to be arguing at a court that your case needs to be stayed, the court's going to say, well, how long am I supposed to stay this? You know, in perpetuity, courts don't really like that because they're trying to move through their cases in congested dockets as much as they can. You might have a better argument with the Marks decision because of the request for the en banc ruling, but you know, that's probably if you're looking for a stay ruling, that's probably a better argument if you're in the Ninth Circuit, because other circuits don't care what the Ninth Circuit said. I think that you know, maybe you get a brief stay based on that, but I don't see it being a really widespread stay culture right now, if you will.
And Mike, just from my perspective, I would only consider it, well, I would not consider it if you had a good defense otherwise, such as the consumer gave consent to be dialed or something like that. You have the written consent and you're going to file a motion for summary judgment. There's no real reason to put that off, in my view. I think a request to stay litigation would be helpful if you're really facing a very expensive trial where you're having to put on expert witness testimony as to the technology you're employing, whether that qualifies under case law, the statutory text of the TCPA, what have you. Anything that helps prolong or preclude the mass expenditure, something like that in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, I'd be all for putting off.
Okay, that stays. What about should collection agencies or companies in the armed industry be more or less inclined to settle TCPA lawsuits? And I know, Jen, I'm going to ask you first. I know you're going to start with it depends, so I'll start your answer for you. It depends.
it largely does, but you know, I'll go ahead and say I don't settle TCPA claims. I feel pretty confident in the strategy and the technology that we use, and unless it's a very good settlement and I just chalk it up as a business nuisance, which is a rare thing, I don't want to create any sort of paper trail that we do not stand behind our technology. So strategically, we just don't settle them. We defend them.
David, Nicole, any other insights into whether you should, in the industry, should be more or less inclined to settle today compared to, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago?
I mean,
gosh,
speaking just from, you know, the agencies that I've worked with before, it's always key to make sure that your processes and your procedures and your technology is on par with, you know, the current legal landscape and the definition of an ATDS, and can you defend it? If you can, then defend it, because you know, the TCPA, it's been around since 91. It's recently in the last, I don't know, 10, 12 years started to become a very, very big thing for our industry. And there's really no reason with the, at least in my view, with the recent decisions that we've had and that we would settle these out if, unless they were, like Jeff was saying, just a business nuisance. But even in those cases, the difference, at least for me, between what I would expend to settle a business nuisance versus what I might expend to get one of these cases dismissed or out in summary judgment is very minute. So I would much rather defend these, not set a precedent for plaintiff attorneys that, you know, this is an agency that you can sue and they'll settle as a nuisance on a TCPA claim. I would much rather defend these and make it known that, you know, this is not really something that we're willing to settle on or willing to negotiate on.
Yeah, I think it's obviously a tough question because it's going to depend on the size of your agency. It's going to depend upon, you know, your resources, and it's going to depend upon your risk. And like the other said, you know, your compliance program, how strong it is. I don't really think much has changed though since Mark's. I mean, at least my clients all seem to be on the same. I haven't seen a difference, you know, with the TCPA cases I defend where, you know, we've all of a sudden say, oh no, you know, Mark's came out. We're now going to, you know, settle all these cases. I don't think it's had anything to do with that. People seem to be on the same strategy that they were taking prior to that ruling. And even prior to ECA International, people are, you know, doing the same thing.
In looking at the data, the number of TCPA lawsuits through the first 8 months of this year is actually down 14% from the same period last year. Is that a trend that you expect to continue? And maybe you can share some insight into why or why not, if you don't think that's the case. Nicole, would you mind taking a first crack at that one?
Sure. You know, if TCPA lawsuits are down, I would probably say that's a result of people using the technologies that have already been established in the courts to not violate the TCPA. Because I can tell you from a defense perspective, a lot of the plaintiffs' counsels that were filing these claims and then have since learned that, you know, the agencies have switched to different technology that maybe has already been tested in the courts a few times, seem to back off and stop the suing. Because once they're charged with that knowledge, it's a big investment for them to, you know, litigate a TCPA case. Yeah, maybe not cash, but I mean, for attorneys, you know, time is money. And so how much time are they going to spend litigating a losing TCPA case over 3 years? You know, do they really want that? Not unless they see it as being, you know, a reasonable probability of success. And, you know, if you're going back to them and saying, listen, my client uses this technology, it's been tried and true and tested, and they're not afraid to fight you, they're going to back off a little bit more than they were prior because we didn't really have a lot of decisions on the technology. Or if we did, you know, they weren't positive decisions. So I think that's probably the result. I mean, at least I've gotten quite a few to back off some of my clients. So I think that's probably the result of that.
Okay, cool. Judd, David, any insights on whether you are you seeing fewer lawsuits like the rest of the industry is sort of as a whole and whether or not you expect that to continue?
Yeah, I completely agree with Nicole's assessment. I think it's collection agencies are becoming more attuned to what technologies are compliant and which aren't. And they're adopting the more compliant ones. And that's, I think, a direct result of that has been this decrease in lawsuits. Certainly successful lawsuits. And I, even with the advent of Marks and the uncertainty in different jurisdictions, I don't really see that as a trend that's going to stop anytime soon. I think we're becoming more sophisticated as an industry.
So does that mean then that, you know, sort of TCPA is something that there's sort of a law of diminishing returns where it's going to become less and less of a concern and eventually sort of fade away. Is that, do you foresee that happening?
I mean, I personally think so. As long as the industry continues down the path that it's going now and technology continues to evolve to adapt, you know, there are certain regulations within the ARM industry, like the FDCPA, the FCRA. When you look at the stats, it's kind of cyclical. You'll see one year, a set of years, FDCPA goes up and another set of FCRA goes up. The TCPA is not one of those regulations. You know, it's almost entirely based on the technology that you use and the practices that you use. And you don't really need to adjust those very often to stay within the bounds and the confines of the TCPA. So I think this is a trend that'll hold.
One of the issues that agencies have, especially when you're dealing sort of in multiple states or multiple jurisdictions, is sort of reconciling, you know, how to kind of comply with those different, what's allowed with those different jurisdictions, especially in an era where, you know, you don't necessarily know where the person you're calling is sort of standing at that point in time. So I'm curious how, you know, how can an agency be sure they're following the proper legal precedent if they aren't sure where the person they are calling is living? Sorry, I meant to say that one, meant to ask that one to Judd, sorry.
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I don't think there's any, I'm not saying there's no good answer, but I do think it's a difficult one. I mean, there are steps you can take, such as trying to isolate consumers' accounts by area code, but, you know, people take their cell phones and move and they don't change their numbers. That's not very reliable. We do a combination of area code and consumer zip code and their mailing address, their home address, to try to divine a strategy based on that. But nothing's going to be 100% foolproof or accurate even with that. It's just something you have to live with. But I do think even though you're going to have a certain percentage of the time, you know, accounts slip through the cracks. The consumer has moved to California, for instance, as having their mail forwarded and did not change to a local area code. How do you know that? You don't. And it's really very difficult to ever know that until they tell you. But I think it goes back to what Nicole mentioned a little bit ago. You want to create these account level fact issues so that these become one-offs, not class actionable claims. So you want to base your strategy on the existence of written consent or at least have a bona fide error defense or something to that extent where, okay, maybe it didn't work in a particular situation, but that's not going to be a systemic problem that holds true for thousands and thousands of consumers.
Thanks. David, what are you at DCI? Is there a way that you sort of manage that?
I mean, I kind of agree with Judd that it's a little bit difficult to manage that, at least from a circuit-to-circuit perspective. I mean, for us, we just kind of base it on consent. If we have consent, we operate one way. If we don't have consent, we operate another, and we operate outside of the ATDS definition using a human contact initiator and loading all of these numbers manually, dialing them manually, either with a clicker agent and then a closer agent. So that we kind of stay outside of that regulation until we have the ability to obtain that consent, and then maybe we might treat that account a little bit differently. But going down the path, and this is just my opinion, right, going down the path of separating this from a circuit-to-circuit basis, that path leads to madness because with what's happening in the Ninth Circuit, that can change very, very quickly. So that's been our approach, and it's been successful thus far. And that's probably the way that we're going to continue until something drastic happens, or if something drastic happens within this landscape that forces us to change.
Okay. Sorry, Nicole, I wanted to sort of put the same question to you in terms of staying on top of the legal rulings and making sure who you're calling, what you should and shouldn't be doing. What advice are you giving to your clients?
Just in terms of, what do you mean? Just in terms of
knowing whether, knowing, you know, if I'm calling a certain area code, but the person in that area code might not be living in that area code anymore. They might have moved, but kept their phone number. So, you know, it's a different jurisdiction. How do you know what you can and can't do in terms of trying to contact that person and make sure you're still complying with the TCPA?
I think the best course of action is just take the most conservative approach of the most conservative circuit. I don't think that most collectors out there anyway are just collecting in one circuit. I mean, the circuits, you know, like the Seventh Circuit is like Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois. I don't think that there's agencies out there really that even just collect in that circuit. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, like David said, with, you know, the cell phones, just how mobile they are, it's probably best to just take the most conservative circuit and, you know, pretend that that's a law everywhere. There's really not that much of a difference. I think really it's more about, you know, your compliance programs and, you know, making sure that those are, your documentation and your policies and procedures are tight to anticipate getting a claim. I think that's the best course of action.
Okay. Well, we're almost out of time. There have been a few questions that have come in. If you have a question, now would be the best time to enter, to type it into the Q&A panel on your Zoom webinar control panel. So we talked a little bit before about the vigilance and sort of staying on top of the legal rulings and other developments. Based on what I'm hearing, and obviously, you know, people feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe it doesn't seem like it's that important to sort of stay on top of a ruling came out last week that I need to sort of adjust, you know, what I'm doing today or the day after. Am I kind of, you know, that, you know, like back what you were saying earlier, Judd, in terms of sort of that cooling off period and sort of waiting to see what happens. Is that the approach, or do you really kind of need to be on top of what's going on as soon as it happens in order to sort of make sure you're doing what you're supposed to be doing?
Oh, well, to me, it's two different things. One is staying on top of things and making sure that you have the latest, most accurate information. The second is what do you do with that information? And that's the kind of, I do think that it needs a calm, reasoned, methodical approach and not just change for the sake of change. But, you know, there's no substitution for staying informed and knowing where the wind is taking you as far as TCPA or really anything when they're talking about compliance or collections. So to that extent, you know, we have a compliance department, and that is one of our obligations, is to keep on top of developments and keep the organization informed as to those developments. From that, strategy can be devised whether we need to change practices or processes or whether we think we're okay in sticking to what we've been doing.
Okay. Nicole, are you seeing any common themes or trends in either the types of TCPA suits that are being filed now? You know, any common sort of, you know, what they're alleging in the complaint, or on the flip side, sort of what you're using or what you're seeing in terms of effective defense strategies against those types of complaints?
So I see a lot of FTCPA, TCPA combo cases. That seems to be like a favorite. There's a couple of firms that I feel like just add in the TCPA claims for good measure. They just assume that it's a dialer. But the plaintiff's firms are pretty good at pleading TCPA claims now. It's really hard to get a TCPA claim out on a motion to dismiss because they know what to write in the complaint. Whether or not that's true, you know, you'll see them write things like, oh, and then there was a pause, and that's how I knew it was an auto dialer. The tough thing about TCPA claims, I think, is that, you know, usually summary judgment is when you're going to have the most successful chance of getting out of the case. And as, you know, most of us know from summary judgment, that's you know, the end of the case, not the beginning. And so you've got the cost of defense up to that point in time, which can be kind of unfortunate. But I haven't really seen, you know, any new strategies of pleading, because it seems like what people have been doing, or at least the firms that are doing it most often, it's been pretty effective for them thus far of getting the complaints, you know, sticking. So not much new there. I mean, in terms of defense strategy, I think, you know, like I said, a lot of the most effective defense strategies come from, you know, our clients' good policies and procedures about what they're using, and just making the case as unattractive for the plaintiff as possible, and also just not being the low-hanging fruit that, you know, doles out the 10 grand every time they get a case, because that plaintiff's attorney keeps knocking on the door again and again and again with the same, you know, set of facts. As a friend of mine says, you want to be the ugliest looking apple on the tree instead of the, you know, the shiny red one. So that's what I'm seeing from the defense side.
Ugliest looking apple on the tree, writing that down. Well, we've just been running out of time, but what I'd like to do is go around the panel and have them offer any summaries or any parting words of wisdom or any takeaways, just a chance to sort of walk out with one last bit of advice from what's been a very interesting and engaging discussion. David, maybe you'd like to go first.
Sure. I mean, a lot of the TCPA claims that we've fought here have been pre-litigation. And with that, I've noticed that there are essentially two common themes, and we're able to get rid of these relatively quickly and easily. One theme, of course, human intervention, and you know, did this actually get dialed by a human? And I think Nicole touched on this slightly. One of the pieces that I see in the language for many pre-litigation demands is typically a it took you a minute to get a person on the phone, essentially, right? So we clicked to dial, and it might have taken a moment before a closure agent got on, and that's something that we adjusted. So make sure that your answer times are very short so that it doesn't lead a consumer to believe that they might have been dialed by any sort of automated system. Usually when we can disprove that, those claims go away very, very quickly. That's my two cents.
Great. Judd?
I think for me, there are kind of two key takeaways that I would want to impart to everyone. The first is make sure that you're using a dialing technology that is TCPA compliant. It's been vetted by multiple courts or jurisdictions. And then once you have that system in place, make sure you're not doing anything to modify or corrupt it, that you're keeping that compliant integrity intact. You're not doing anything to change the nature of the system to where it changes the potential capacity or anything like that. And the second thing that I think is important to keep in mind is really hammer that prior express consent or the implied consent. As David mentioned, you know, most of the claims that we will see are not in lawsuits, but they're in pre-lit demands. And the best way to make those go away, show that the technology actually used to dial that attorney's client has been analyzed already by a court and is deemed to be compliant. And secondly, hey, your client already said we could do this. And there's not really a counter argument that the attorney can make to that unless there's some sort of revocation issue that you just didn't know about. And that goes a long way towards making these types of claims just go away without having to write a big check on them.
Excellent. Nicole, any takeaways?
Gosh, I was answering people's questions, and so I stopped listening. I'm sorry, guys.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to sort of share any takeaways, any last advice before we dismiss the call.
Oh, gosh. I would just say, you know, keep educating yourselves out there about, you know, what's going on. Find your person to bounce ideas off of. And, you know, just make sure you're keeping yourself aware of, you know, the stuff that's coming out and, you know, the new rules and court decisions and, you know, it's an ever-changing compliance system. So, you know, you can't really have a static in time compliance program. So that's my best advice.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate that. Before I let everybody go, I want to thank Nicole, Judd, and Dave for their insights and their time today. Really appreciate them taking the time to share this information with us and participate. I also want to thank TCN again for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.tcnp3 to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Recording of this event will be posted on the site in the next couple of days. And I hope everybody enjoys the rest of their day. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks.